miss you when I
back, everyone. For today, I'm actually joined with Khalil, who you might remember from the Wonderful and Strange Twin Peaks logcast. And before we get too much further into Doc Hayward, I'll hand over the mic so he can introduce himself further.
Hi, I go by Khalil on the internet. Like was said, you can find me in the Wonderful and Strange Twin Peaks logcast. There was a podcast I was doing with my co-host, The Unplugged Professor, and we recently completed that in April after like 78 episodes. We went over the original series, the return, the books, all the David Lynch films, and some weird behind-the-scenes stuff, the whole gamut for like hours and hours and hours. I also have a YouTube channel. Find me on Snake Eye Dreams. Do some Twin Peaks stuff there, cover some of the Twin Peaks books, as well as do some videos on a wide range of topics, including anime like Revolutionary Girl Utena, Sir Experiments Lane, and Cowboy Bebop. So thank you so much for letting me be a part of this. I know that you've had an Evangelion anime person on before, so I'm glad to represent the Utena side as well.
Normally, whenever I start off these sort of episodes, usually I start off with stuff in chronological order, such as like, you know, the secret history or something of that nature. But because on your show, you have brought up on more than a few occasions a very interesting take of Doc Hayward. For anyone who has not listened to your show or the final thoughts, do you want to give like a certain broad stroke of how you view Doc Hayward in the wider landscape of Twin Peaks?
Absolutely. So I have a bit of a complicated feeling on Dr. Hayward. And just to preface this, it doesn't mean I hate the character. I find him actually quite interesting. It's just that as we were going through the original series, but also other material, there just kept being these things that would pop up that made me look at Doc Hayward and kind of just squint and just wonder what exactly his real role is in the story, because he's in a lot of episodes. Like, at least to my count, he's in 28 episodes of the original series, and he's in part 7 of The Return. He's in a few of the books and in The Missing Pieces. And so he's in Twin Peaks in terms of just numbers of appearances, I believe more than James Hurley, just by episode count. Obviously, that doesn't mean screen time, but he's in the show so often, but I don't hear a lot of discourse on Doc Hayward. And maybe I'm just not in the right segments. I'm not in the right back alleys that are discussing Doc Hayward 24/7, but I just don't hear it. And I think that's interesting because he's so often there. And the way my co-host described it to me just off pod, we were talking about this, he said that Doc Hayward is the personification of a white lie. And that reflects how I feel about him too, that he represents this sort of well-meaning but ultimately harmful element of the town of Twin Peaks that doesn't confront the real secrets and the real damaging issues, but sort of pacifies them, moves on from them very quickly, oftentimes very soft-spokenly, which doesn't allow things to get addressed. And this doesn't mean, like, I think all the authors of Twin Peaks and David Lynch and Mark Frost and all the writers intended that consistently, but it's enough in the fiction that that's kind of become my headcanon with it. And all that said, I still, if you were to like force me somehow to do the impossible and put Dr. Hayward on a spectrum of good White Lodge and bad Black Lodge and have to plot every character as though it were that black and white, I would still put Dr. Hayward like in the top 15% or so of good people. Like, he is generally a nice family man. He's very considerate. He does a lot of good work for the town, maybe too much work. The guy's always busy. But in the moments where we see that darker side come out, he has that real darkness in him, whether it's explicit violence toward other characters or the softer form of darkness of lies built upon lies. So my feelings on Dr. Hayward are a bit complicated, and I think that's what makes him so fun to talk about, because I think there should be more discussion on the guy.
In terms of stuff about the white lies, I completely glossed over this from the Access Guide. I'm going to pull up page 106, where for anyone who's read the Access Guide, they'll know that there's like little bios of sorts for all these characters. And whether they're accurate or not is totally up to them. But what I have to mention is that on page 106, it says, Will Doc Hayward, born May 25th, 1929, a multifaceted man, Gemini Doc, graduated from the University of Minnesota, where he learned people will believe almost anything if it's said softly enough and with enough sincerity. With a with a medical degree from the University of Washington, this expert on euthanasia is a past president of the Northwest chapter of the AMA. While his bedside manner has been helpful in nursing many back to health, Doc wishes he could spend more time with his family. Now, for the most part, this actually sounds innocuous enough, but of all characters, the fact that it says he learned in the University of Minnesota that people learned they will believe almost anything if it's said softly and with enough sincerity is a very strange thing to throw in there. And I think it's strange how it fits in well with what you have to say about the white lie aspect. Do you have any particular thoughts about the factor of him in the access guide and how it fits in with your feelings and also the unemployed professor's feelings?
I'm glad you highlighted that quote because that's definitely one of the eyebrow-raising moments for us. I think there's hints in the show to that idea, but this is one of those cases where the access guide, despite having some kind of strange elements that you've pointed out in previous episodes where we're wondering who was on assignment to make this thing in universe, that it has these sort of weird elements to it. This is one where whoever wrote that about Doc Hayward in universe, I think tapped into some kind of truth that maybe says a lot about his kind of role in the story. So in terms of what backstory we get, we learn from the Secret History and the Access Guide kind of together that Doc Hayward's father, who I was seeing referred to as Dan Hayward, founded their medical practice in Twin Peaks in 1925. So they have roots going back to the mid or early, I should say, 20th century. And the Access Guide adds that Will Hayward was born 4 years later in 1929. So grew up with his father, who we really don't know that much about. I wasn't seeing a lot of intel on their family history. One thing I thought was interesting, though, was that in the Secret History, it does mention that in 1947, it was Will Hayward's father who was the physician who looked at Margaret Lannerman after she and those two other children disappeared in the woods. So that's a brush in really early on, or at least an indirect brush in with something strange, something unexpected and unnatural potentially. But from what we gather of the report, Dan Hayward approaches it rather rationally, not leaning too far into mystery or superstition. Like, he's not jumping over the board like Jacoby would have if he got wind of that. So I think kind of the background we get from what little we have is that growing up, he had this environment of maybe a bit of skepticism, a bit of well-rounded kind of looking at things from multiple angles and not jumping to conclusions. And when we see Doc Hayward with Margaret Lannerman, because he is sometimes with her, it doesn't seem like he's playing into some of the more strange elements that she might say, but he's also not combating it or fighting against it. In a lot of ways, he seems like a mediator throughout the entire show. So going back to that quote, it feels like Dr. Hayward's role is so passive sometimes because a lot of times he is the one sitting next to someone, putting his hand on their arm and saying it's all right, no matter what they're saying, and just consoling them, telling them what they want to hear, not always in a lying sense, but in the sense of comfort. And I think that's his number one goal. So when we mention euthanasia, I think of it less in terms of he's a killer, like it's a Kevorkian. No, I don't think like that. I think more in the sense that he is someone who calms someone into a peace. And of course, there's darker elements the moment you start talking about that with death. And maybe that ties into the show and the themes of Twin Peaks as a town that maybe could fit that prognosis as well. A town slowly dying from not addressing its problems.
Yeah, I guess before we really go into anything about the Secret History, I think one of the factors that that we see with Lynch that he gravitates to, and actually anyone who's watched Lynch Oz will know that John Waters, he actually talks about this, where he talks about how him and Lynch, they have a weird love-hate relationship with the 50s, where there's just something about like the lifestyle at the time, where there's a lot of stuff that was swept under the rug, and that's kind of just like, it was just a thing that people accepted at that time. And I think that the way Will Hayward just handles himself is like he's very strongly emblematic of that. Like, you know, with the Palmers, it's like a very malevolent evil. With Sarah, you could say passive evil of knowing what's happened to Laura. But in the case of the Hayward home, it's always the stuff that's like innocuous enough, barring one that we'll get to. But it's always innocuous stuff where it's like you can kind of get why Will and Eileen would go about that way. But it doesn't change the fact that things get really ugly once it rears its ugly head.
I think in Twin Peaks, there's so many outlandish characters who are exaggerations of what we might normally encounter in real life, where you know people who are deceptive. Maybe they do shady business practices, but they're not Ben Horn, right? And I hope you don't know a Ben Horn, but you might know people who have aspects of these characters, but not to the degree. And obviously with the Palmer family, there's this really uncomfortable marriage between the supernatural evil that's so far out of what we expect versus the very grounded, real darkness of what oftentimes the Laura story is about, a case of terrible abuse. And so a lot of these characters, at least in part, serve as exaggerations. I don't feel that way about the Hayward family. They feel very realistic and down to earth and not especially soap opera-y either. I think there's moments where there's tenderness and the music kicks in when Doc Hayward's talking with Donna or Eileen. But generally, I believe in them as characters that you could just meet a family like the Palmers. You could meet a family like the Haywards very realistically. So I think that that's pretty interesting. But then in the scope of Twin Peaks, how does that fit in? Because I don't feel like they're oftentimes you cut to the Haywards or Doc Hayward specifically to get the sense of like, this is the average normal family. And like, that's either our point of view or that's the main thing to study. In fact, the Haywards, especially Doc Hayward, they don't feel like they're looked at that often. And there's this weird relationship because I mentioned earlier that Dr. Hayward's in so many episodes, but so much in the background. And one of the things that struck me as I was watching again for these notes and kind of looking at what Dr. Hayward's role is that he simultaneously seems to occupy a very important role in the story, especially season one, but also not. So to elaborate what I mean by that, we see him taking a pretty active role in the investigation. He goes with them to Jacques' apartment. He is involved with going to Margaret Lanterman's place. He's also following them, not going into Jacques' cabin, but going to it, later feeding Waldo to make sure that their prime suspect, not suspect, but witness lives. I don't think Waldo was ever a suspect, but he's obviously caretaking there. He seems to be privy to a lot of information that I don't think he always needs to know. He's obviously not cleared as like part of the investigation team. Obviously, he's going to work with some medical issues, but it seems to like there's a bit of a trust going beyond that. While at the same time, he's not a bookhouse boy. And if we go by his conversations with Donna, he doesn't really know James or Ed very much. When Ed's brought up, Dr. Hayward is like, oh, his wife's the lady with the eye patch, right? So it doesn't seem like he's even 100% certain there, which I think is interesting because so much in the small town of Twin Peaks, who you are is based on your family and your heritage. So if he doesn't really feel like he knows the Hurleys very much, I don't get the sense, again, he's even that close to the Bookhouse boys or Harry particularly, even if they're seen a lot together. I think that's interesting. The one that jumped out at me was there's a shot in that episode where they're like going to the cabin where you get a hero lineup where it's Cooper, Harry, Hawk, and then the fourth spot is Dr. Hayward. And they're, you know, lined up dramatically, and it's like this cool shot. And I feel like that's true early on. But by the time you get to episode 16, there's a contrast where it's Cooper, Truman, and Hawk again, but it's Albert walking with them. And this is around that time of like Leland's passing, those four walking dramatically like the cool heroes of Twin Peaks. And considering everything that's friction between Dr. Hayward and Albert, the fact that he kind of gets usurped by Albert in that role, even just implicitly, I find to be really interesting because they don't stand for the same things.
I know we mentioned this before we recorded. My notes about Will pertain to the Laura Palmer murder. I just had like very little just because he always felt like he was there and like he had a role, but it wasn't as active as, say, Cooper or Truman. And I'm going to come back to like the last quote from the Access Guide, where he says he wishes he spent more time with his family, because there's a lot of factors that like tie to the Hayward family about what probably would have set off what we get at the events near the end of season two. Because I guess we'll start off with saying that he did take over the family practice in 1952 that his father started in 1925. And this is after he completed his postgraduate at the University of Washington. At some point, he would marry Eileen, and he would have children, Donna, Harriet, and Gersten. But the one thing I found interesting that I don't think is at least explicitly brought up is that Harriet and Gersten, they have red hair. And then with Donna, there is something. I mean, obviously, Eileen has like dark brown hair as well, and you could chalk it up to it. But I feel like there's a lot of stuff that just can kind of fit in with the idea that Donna doesn't quite fit in with the family. Like, for example, one scene in season one that I do think about, it's the scene when we have Audrey's dance. Do you think that with Will and Eileen, when they see Audrey, do you think there's this thing in their head of like, oh God, it's Donna's half-sister? There's like a strange way that they look at her that I think it just, at the time when they made it, it was just like, oh, Audrey's being a little bit quirky and idiosyncratic. But there's something about like the way the Haywards act where I was like, there has to be something going through Will and Eileen's mind now that we know that Donna is the daughter, the biological daughter of Ben Horn.
I usually subscribe to on our podcast the idea of death of the author to some extent, where especially in a work like Twin Peaks, where there's so many different competing authors, not just David Lynch versus Mark Frost, where they may disagree on some interpretations, but also all the other writers and directors who worked on the show, who worked on the books down the line. In my heart of hearts, I don't believe early on when they were making season one, especially, they had in their heads, all the writers were in agreement that secretly Donna was really the daughter of Ben Horn the whole time. I feel like that was something that developed later on in terms of the writer intentions. Now, that being said, as a show, we get to do the fun thing of attaching later information to earlier. And in that sense, it totally makes sense that when the Haywards are looking at Ben Horn and Audrey, and maybe Johnny to some extent, they're going to be thinking of those sort of connections and parallels that retroactively get added on. And I want to say at this time, when I first watched the show, like for the first time years and years ago, I remember really not caring for the Ben Horn is the real father plotline because it felt especially soap opera-y to me in a way that was like too far for Twin Peaks. And I say this as someone who liked most of the stuff in season two that other people dislike and was tolerant of a lot of it. But that was one where it's like, oh, I was never wondering who Donna's real father is. This seems like inventing a fake problem. However, the more time that's gone on, the more I look at it, I feel like that scenario with Ben Horn does so much for Dr. Hayward's character, especially, that I don't even know if his character would feel complete if it wasn't for that being revealed as a central lie, especially given like that quote you mentioned earlier. There's this idea that until you have Dr. Hayward really tested, put him in a situation where his best intentions of not telling the truth are being confronted, you don't really know what he's like. You have to test him like that. And this situation provided that ultimate test. So I think it's fun to think in the background this whole entire time, he's maybe in his heart hoping that Donna does not spend much time with Audrey because she might piece things together. And Audrey's very intelligent, very gifted at figuring things out. You don't want Audrey to give Donna those ideas either. But we also in the show, I don't think see any clear evidence that he's trying to distance the families. If anything, it seems like he gets along cordially well with Ben, at least in terms of appearances. So, and again, the fact that there's the Palmer family wedged in between, where it's revealed at one point at like a dinner that, you know, Leland is the lawyer, not just for Ben, but also for Doc Hayward. There is this kind of mediator factor of Laura, Leland, that family wedged between the Horns and the Haywards in multiple ways. And I just wonder what would have happened if the Doc Hayward and Leland collision would have happened when Leland was still their lawyer. Like if Doc Hayward would have vaulted Ben Horn into a fireplace when Leland was representing both of them, how would that have turned out between them?
Actually, on the topic of the Palmers, I think that we're going to backpedal a little bit, but I have to bring up Doc Hayward's scene in The Missing Pieces because it's obviously this is around the time when Laura comes back to Donna's home, extremely distressed because of the whole Bob Leland incident. And then, like, you know, she has the Donna, are you my friend? And then she comes in and it seems like some time passes. And then Doc Hayward comes in. He does a magic trick. And, you know, he's like, the rose, where's the red rose? He says that it said it worked near the light at Sparkwood in 21. And the thing is that this is veering away from Doc Hayward for a moment. But there's something about that light that's so prominent in the original series, or even Fire Walk With Me, because that's where Laura runs off after James stops. Did you ever have any thoughts about the light itself? And do you think there's something about this magic trick that may or may not have hindered it?
I feel like if you ask me this in a few years, maybe I'll have an idea. But right now, all I know is I've always appreciated the visual of the light. I've always appreciated the kind of ominous tone that the light may convey. But in this exact situation, it does leave me scratching my head. I feel like the main thing is this ominous sort of warning for Laura and this fear of like whether or not her hope will materialize. If the red rose represents maybe the hope or Laura or a savior. If you want to say that Dale Cooper is the red rose, he sure does materialize in one timeline. So it makes you wonder there. But I don't know when that line was being written and put into the show or to the missing pieces, I should say, in this case. What exactly was the intent there? And I also don't feel like Doc Hayward would have any like special knowledge either. If I think of it in terms of his character, this is out of nowhere. He says ipso facto like it's a spell chant, just using his most stock Latin he could think of. And I don't know if he has any clue of the significance of what he's saying as he's saying it.
I would actually agree that he's not, there's not that intuitive part of like understanding anything pertaining to the light of Sparkwood in 21. But I guess to go off where I talk about the light is that I feel like the light, it's sort of like that little indicator of wind, because wind is like a thing that Lynch, even from the very early days of painting, that was something that he was transfixed by. I always felt that seeing that light swaying was like indicative of like there's something malevolent in the air in one form or another. And so I think that when I think of that light, I think of just like what the wind insinuates, where I look at the wind in almost like a secondary manner when I think of the original series and even Fire Walk With Me, but I look at it as a very unwieldy, malevolent force in the return. So I just wondered if there was something about that magic trick, about maybe Doc Hayward doesn't quite understand something about the light, and that maybe that was like some sort of influence. Admittedly, I don't know if I can really fully articulate it, but I just thought it was always interesting about why it would work at this light that's so central, that this light was actually on the VHS box for the international pilot. It just feels like with Lynch being like mainly at the helm, alongside Bob Engels, that there was something that was deliberate about that line. But to come back to the scene at hand, Laura, she is crying, and then he quote-unquote gives the prescription slash secret message to her about the angels. Now, I have to say is that I mentioned this in my Missing Pieces episode about Laura. As much as I like this scene, I'm glad it was not in the movie, because I feel like it would allude too much to what the ending is. It just has such like a attention foreshadowing and progress type of feel. It's sort of like I mentioned this on previous episodes, there's stuff that I love watching independent from Fire Walk Me, but I'm glad it didn't make it in the final cut.
Yeah, I would probably put myself in that camp as well. I think it's so on the nose that, again, it doesn't really say anything about Donna and Doc Hayward unless you believe they have special access to this information, or a force is working through them in a moment of you know, collusion with the forces of outside of humanity or something. But I feel like within the world, it doesn't make sense for them to say this. And it gives so much already to the audience that maybe destroys or hinders some of the mystery and wonder of the ending. So I'd probably be on the same page as that. I do think it's a really nice gesture from Donna, if we read it to be that she's trying to help her friend have a sense of hope. So she has her, it whispers to her dad to use this like this and try to help Laura out. I think it's a nice gesture. It's a beautiful moment between those characters as people, but for the grander picture, I think I would agree with you.
And obviously, like, I remember I asked this question when I did the Laura Palmer episode with Scott, where I actually did ask at one point if he thought if it was Doc Hayward that wrote that, because he's the one who says it's not prescription, it's a secret message. But it makes sense for Donna, because there's that scene where she says that, where Laura says that the angels wouldn't help you because they've all gone away. So it's like a really good segue for Donna to be that sort of friend. But the one thing to mention about Will in this scene is that the phone rings, and Leland is on the line, and he says, well, Laura, it's for you. There's something that's like I notice is that Will and Eileen, as Laura's leaving, they have very concerned looks, and it lingers on it for a while. It lingers on a lot longer than I recalled, you know, the last time I watched it. And it makes me think of that scene in season one when Bobby says we all knew something was wrong. And there's just some words like they wouldn't linger on that for a family who knows the Palmers so well without having some like inkling that something horrible is going on at home. Would you say this is a scene that embodies the whole, he's a good person, but there's this passive evil that he just sweeps under the rug for him?
This one's so tough because I don't think we have any clear cut proof in any of the Twin Peaks material that he knew for sure what was going on in the Palmer household. There is an argument that you could make that even those who didn't know the specifics of what was happening in that home could tell that Laura was troubled. And there's lines where Donna talks either to her parents or about her parents that seem to imitate that, or intimate, I should say, that Donna doesn't think that her parents really know Laura as well. There's a part I'm remembering, I don't remember which episode it is, but I think it's her talking with her mother, Eileen, I want to say. And she makes a comment about how like Laura was really troubled, really going through things. And it feels like, at least in Donna's perspective, she had a better idea than her parents did. But Donna doesn't necessarily know that for sure. She doesn't know everything going on in her parents' heads. So there's that element of, I don't even know with myself, do I think Donna's right and her parents really didn't know? Or do I think that Donna believed she had this knowledge of Laura that actually was a bit of an open secret that other characters picked up on, including her parents? And even though they may not have known the specifics on what was going on, it's possible the Haywards sensed that this was not a great situation. And then considering, we know that Will has some proximity to Leland as it is like his legal representation. They have to talk. There's family dinners where they get together. It's not like, oh, it's my daughter's friend's family. I don't really know them, never met them. It's not like he doesn't know the Hurleys. This is different. He clearly knows the Palmers to some extent. So this does get suspicious with the missing pieces. If you latch onto the scene, the amount of like unspoken concern shared between between Eileen and Dr. Hayward, it does make me wonder if they had some knowledge. But then there's the argument of the missing pieces were cut for maybe a reason. Is this still canon or true to you if you cut that out? Because outside of this moment, I'm struggling to think of anything else that really indicates that they knew.
That's a good point. When I look at Fire Walk With Me, I look at it definitely with the movie, a little more tangentially with the missing pieces, but I look at it through Laura's perspective. I think that's kind of how I write off a lot of the continuity errors in terms of like hair or like a lot of things that don't align with the original series, that with Laura, trauma and memory don't go quite hand in hand. Like case in point, like the Hayward home, like it changes from the missing pieces to the pilot back to the original series. And there's like little things where it's like, you just kind of have to accept it. But on the topic of Laura, is that, you know, we were talking about before we recorded about how Doc Hayward, he's not explicitly talked about in the secret diary. At least he's not like a central character, certainly not the way Donna is. But Laura definitely views him as like a father figure. Like there's a part where she wants to keep her secrets full guarded, especially from him, because she feels like it would break her heart if he found out. Before we get into everything about Laura after she's killed, did you have any thoughts about her relationship with Doc Hayward from the secret diary and what we see in the missing pieces?
Yeah, no, actually I had quite a bit written down regarding the secret diary. It's not a lot in terms of the word count of the book, but I feel like when you're looking specifically at Doc Hayward as a character, having Laura's point of view is so interesting and important to understand maybe how he felt to other people. We don't get a lot of people in the show talking about how they feel about Dr. Hayward. So Laura's perspective, I think, becomes even more important. So on one hand, we learn, as I mentioned earlier, that they have these family nights with the Palmer family, which we see some of that in the show. But to know that it was more of like a recurring thing that they would do these dinner parties in addition to their own private family nights. And there's mention that at least once, and I would suspect more than once, they've gone to parties that Benjamin Horn was throwing. So again, even though there was that tension, Dr. Hayward would have gone to those parties, and that's why he wasn't home a particular night when Laura and Donna were seeking out of the house. So there's that element in which they are still socially active, at least with those two families. In terms of Laura's thoughts, she writes in the diary that of all the men that she'd ever known, and she was quite young when she wrote this, it's earlier on in the book, but she said out of all the men she had ever known, Dr. Hayward had been the most loving to her. He's unselfish, kind, and quote, always showed her a gentle smile of inspiration and forgiveness. So going back to that idea of sort of being a mediator, being someone who gives peace, he's this person in her life that all she's seen of him is kindness, compassion, and this is someone she could go to if she needs a little bit of a boost, a little bit of a feel-good conversation. And she imagines that the day he delivered her in the hospital, at least her imagination, was one of the best moments and warmest moments of her life, because she believes, at least in her head, that the way he held her without saying a word, that comfort, that if she ever came to him again, he could offer that kind of warmth and kindness again. She describes him as having a grandfather's sweetness inside a father's helping hand. And I think if anything, this shows how much Laura valued him, not just as, oh, that's Donna's dad. This is something a bit more, but it doesn't indicate that they were always talking, always close to each other. It's more the idea that she had a Doc Hayward in her pocket. And if she needed at any point to seek that comfort, this was someone she knew that she could, which makes me wonder, did she? how often did she? Because we know that Laura went through so many troubles, and in the diary, it doesn't seem like she goes to him very much. And the closest we get, maybe outside of that, is that missing pieces scene where she was, I think, more so visiting Donna. So there's this feeling of this is someone she could go to for help. Then why doesn't she? Well, the closest I was able to find for an answer for that is that she was writing later about Bobby selling drugs and Mike and all that. And she said that she doesn't want this to happen because if Bobby sells drugs with Mike and Mike ever tells Donna, then Donna would tell her father and Laura wouldn't be able to handle that. She writes that Dr. Hayward being disappointed in her would kill her for sure. So this is, to me, the sign of why she didn't go to Dr. Hayward. Despite the fact that he is this warmth and kindness, she doesn't want his judgment. She doesn't want to disappoint him. And if she goes and disappoints him, that would crush her even more. So out of fear of doing that, she doesn't go to him.
I'm glad you brought up the thing about Mike Nelson being affiliated with the drugs, because for that scene, I always thought it was like, wow, it's like Laura like really thought like just the chain reaction of just like Mike being a part of it, that he wouldn't be able to keep quiet. And then Donna would have to tell Doc. Again, it's you do bring up, I like what you said about how with Laura, she doesn't really spend time with Doc Hayward, but there's something about that approval that she really pines for that I feel like is very central. Something that you don't see from Leland, because in Fire Walk With Me, Laura doesn't know that Leland is Bob truly until the night before she's killed. But it's still very telling that she keeps this thing separate, but out of the two, she feels like she feels more comfortable with Doc Hayward. So yeah, I really love what you had to say about everything with the secret diary.
The last thing I had on the diary that maybe ties into other factors too, is that we read here that Donna and Laura had champagne at Dr. Hayward's birthday party, which I would imagine if it's his birthday party, he may have known that they were drinking the champagne. This was an event that would have happened in 1984, according to what I wrote from the book. So I don't know the exact ages, but clearly they would have been underage. And in the pilot episode, it reminded me of how he obviously knows that Mike and Bobby are drinking and driving. He does a bit of a frown, but he doesn't really say anything or stop them or intervene at all. And then later in the diary, Laura writes about how Mike is this pig. She doesn't like the way that he looks at Donna. And she worries and she writes that she can't believe Dr. Hayward hasn't said something. So if you wanted to paint Dr. Hayward as a very passive kind of parent, not just to Donna, but to other teenagers he interacts with, he sees that they're drinking. He sees that they're drinking and driving. He sees that, you know, his daughter's making poor boyfriend decisions, but he generally doesn't seem to say anything. And you could argue that maybe he shouldn't. Maybe he should just let them make their mistakes. The hard part is, does he know the extent to which that this alcohol later leads into parties, later leading into much worse things, especially for Laura? Does he have concern about those things? And I don't know what to make of it and how far to run with it. I don't think it's 100% a bad look for him that he doesn't speak up every single situation. There's a case to be made for letting the teenagers make their own mistakes, but it is a recurring theme, not just in the show, but also in the book.
Actually, I'm glad you brought up that part about Mike Nelson, because I don't want to gloss over too much, but in the pilot, Will is there with Harry Truman when they unravel Laura's body. Which I have to say is that Warren Frost and Michael Ancine like sold that scene like perfectly. Both obviously as actors, but just to embody how important Laura is. But the reason why I'm bringing this up is that because Laura is killed, Cooper shows up and he talks about the curfew. And this is coming back to what we're saying about Mike and Bobby, more so Mike in this case, because when Mike shows up to the doorstep in the pilot, he goes up and Will answers like, you two haven't been drinking, have you? Mike, he throws off this like really bad lie. He's like, well, we're really shook up. Besides, Bobby's the designated driver. And I was like, there's so much wrong with this scene. Because one, I'm pretty sure drunk driving, at least in big cities, which I know Twin Peaks is not, but it was largely illegal at that point. So that's already like a big thing to kind of overlook. But the fact that it's curfew after his daughter's best friend has been killed and he saw the body. Out of all the things I thought, oh, I'm surprised Will is actually kind of allowing this, is that he goes upstairs. He doesn't tell him to go away. He's like, yeah, I'll go upstairs and get Donna. Then it's like, it kind of changes because when he finds out that Donna is not home, he comes back down and then Mike is like, oh, we'll find her. And I don't know. I feel like Mike is a little too foreboding for Will to be comfortable with that either. It's really the only scene where I feel like Doc Hayward's out of character, but was there anything else we should keep in mind about his relationship with Mike Nelson?
just kind of going back to what you were saying there, we definitely get a sense that he is disappointed and not approving in his tone of voice, but he doesn't stop it either. I think what's interesting then, going back to what Laura wrote in the diary about not wanting to be judged by him, is that I understand if she's concerned that if she told Doc Hayward things, he would judge her and be disapproving. But it seems like of the adults you could tell about these things, he is someone who does allow them to make mistakes. He allows teenagers to make mistakes. Even the way that he talks to Donna after she runs home, he repeats how glad he is to have a daughter like her. He quickly says that he understands Donna wouldn't do something like this if she didn't have a good reason to. And he doesn't make her explain why she did it. He quickly changes the subject, in fact, to the bicycle thing and laughs that off. So if there was any adult to talk to and be like, hey, I've gotten in some real bad stuff with drugs, I've gotten in some real bad stuff that, you know, no one can know about, I think he'd be the one you probably could tell, and he might be able to just keep it between the two of you. If you told someone, obviously you wouldn't tell Harry these things, but if you told even Leland, there's a chance he might really react to that outside of the darker elements of his character. There's just that unknown about a lot of the adult figures in Laura's life and in most of the town, even. I don't know how Ed would react either as part of the bookhouse. He might have a reaction about some of these things too. So it's this interesting situation where I understand Laura's concern, but I just wish that maybe she had opened up to him. But then also seeing how he handles other situations where when he is angered, he can be volatile. And when he does judge things, it can be damaging. And he also has issues with his own family. I do wonder, okay, well, how would he have handled those things? So with Mike, I don't really have anything else to say other than how, again, it illuminates more aspects of Dr. Hayward's approach to young people that are associated with his daughter. I also, with Laura's side of things, the only other two things I had is that in the show, he mentions that since he delivered Laura, he knew her all of his life. He says he couldn't bring himself to do the postmortem. So he called in, of course, most important Twin Peaks character, Joe Fielding from Fairville, who I'm assuming you have an episode on him later, so don't want to get too much into Joe Fielding here. But he also later says that he was talking about the details of her death, going over what Joe Fielding found. And it seems like he was genuinely affected. It seems like in his tone of voice, this really bothered him on a personal level to even mention these things. At one point, he stops and looks at Laura's photo and just talks about how beautiful she is, wonders how anyone can do something like this. And it's before he stops, he's talking about the psychological impact of the fear on Ronette. And it made me think of that often comparison later in the show of fear and love, that in this conversation where he's looking at the postmortem details and talking about Ronette, it goes directly from the psychological impact of fear on Ronette, the survivor, to how could the killer do something like this to someone so beautiful and so good? And both of those mixing in Doc Hayward at that moment. And there are these moments where I think even though he's a pretty simple character, he generally is a calm character, there is that undercurrent of internal conflict that happens where he is torn up about things, maybe more than he lets on.
Actually, one of the scenes that you brought up that actually, for me, it's why I really like his character. It's when you were talking about when he gets down at the sheriff's station, where it's he's very unexpected because he looks very unhappy when he goes up to Harriet and he finds out that she snuck out. But when he's talking to her, he's like, oh, I understand you wouldn't do this in most other circumstances, but how are we going to get Harriet's bike back? And it's just the way he changes the conversation, it just feels like he's this very comfortable person to be around, even in the midst of a very serious conflict. The next thing I want to mention is that it's not too long after, because Donna starts seeing James. And he and Eileen seem to like him well enough. I know that with Donna, she had more of an explicit conversation with Eileen about James and Laura, where it's she feels she's living this horrible nightmare and this wonderful dream at the same time. But we don't get anything about Will. Do you think just this general lighthearted passivity is something that's part of it? Or do you think there's something else he likes about James?
I think it's interesting because James in some ways represents a straightforwardness and simple honesty that we later find even Doc Hayward doesn't have himself. There's this part I was rewatching before this recording where I want to say it's like episode 5 if you count the pilot as episode 0, or it's episode 6 if you count the pilot as episode 1, whichever one you want to call that. And there's this part where James and Donna are talking, and James is telling Donna all about his family. And he's saying all these hard truths about his mother, about his background, that, you know, her alcoholism. And he says all this to Donna. He's like, I hope this isn't bothering you. And Donna's like, no, it's fine. You can say it. And James says that he just wants there to be no lies between them. He says it's the secrets that people keep that destroy any chance of happiness. And so I feel like if I were to read into why does Doc Hayward like James, James is a nice kid who seems to mean everything he says on the surface. And there's no hidden agendas. And that's very clear. He's not a complicated sort of person. And compared to Mike Nelson, compared to other people that maybe he's seen Donna with, even Laura seems troubled, however you want to read into that, that James is a guy who doesn't have secrets. He's not going to be doing something criminal on the side. And I think that's immediately readable. And I say that not as like the number one fan of James, but as looking at it from Dr. Hayward's perspective, he's a nice kid.
And I know we talk about Will and how he plays a role with helping the Laura Palmer murder. And it seems like he kind of does the work that's kind of expected from him. But it's kind of funny because we were talking about before we recorded about how he has like a certain role in season one, but season two is where things really get crazy. Like his day-to-day life just goes insane, because in the season one finale, we have all these people that go to Calhoun Memorial Hospital, and we have Cooper who gets shot, and then Will removes the bullet that has the tick on it. And then he tends to Shelley, who has suffered at the Packard sawmill almost being burned down. And then Leo gets shot. So there's all these, like, right away, there's like these things that are starting to overlap. And then there's Ed and Nadine, because Nadine tried ending her life. And that's not even going to the fact that later that night, he has dinner with the Palmers. Like, how does this guy, like, there's no way this guy slept during, like, the season one finale, season two premiere. This guy is, like, working crazy hours. And I think that's, they said that there was a fire in 1959 where nothing has been that chaotic in decades. And Will's at the center of it. This is the kind of where his trajectory changes, because he's going to deal with a lot of medical stuff and a lot of dead bodies going this point forward.
Yeah, he's probably one of the busiest people in the town. I know that in our podcast, we'd often talk about how it feels like Hawk is doing the work of like the whole entire police force just on his own some days. He's like carrying everything. But I feel in terms of the health and wellness, I don't know how this town survives, quite literally survives without him. There are other doctors. We see one at some point talk about the food at the hospital being really bad. So we know the other doctors exist. Also, just on that note, I do need to get this out of the way, that food situation, so weird to me that it gets emphasized like two different times with Bobby and with Pete, and the camera work on it. It looks like a palette of like paint almost with like different colors. One of which I want to mention is like a liquidy yellow, not quite cream corn, but it does make me a little bit suspicious that it's such a gross display of food. And I don't know why the joke is made more than once, like in the same episode, about how bad the food is. So part of me wants to read into it like, oh yes, is it secretly meaningful that they're serving disgusting food? I have no idea. I just thought that was weird that they kept showing that.
I always kind of looked at the food as like this hilarious gag of sorts. I honestly, when I think of the food, as much as I like Bobby's line saying that's like, oh, we gotta get you out of here, this food's gonna kill you if you eat it. But I love that with Jack Nance, there's that part where he removes the tubes from his nose, smells it, and has this visceral reaction. It's such like a weird thing, but it's like, it's one of those things of Twin Peaks where, because it has this very weird humor that you wouldn't expect even in today's shows, but it's just something I love. But the only other thing I really have of like major note, and like before Leland's revealed to be a killer, I really think there's an interesting interaction that Cooper has with Doc Hayward after Leland is confirmed to have killed Jacques Renault. And this is one I actually think about in terms of, usually I think it through the lens of Cooper, but I also think about Hayward's logic, because Cooper doesn't have a family, but Doc Hayward does. Because after Leland says explicitly he killed Jacques Renault, there's a part when they're walking out and Doc Hayward just has this like, oh, poor Leland, like after all the stuff he's been through. And Cooper stops in a very standoffish manner. He's like, do you approve of murder? And of course, Hayward, he just says no, but he at least can sympathize with it. Where do you stand on Cooper versus Hayward in this situation?
So, a few thoughts on this. First of all, in I believe it's the pilot, right after Laura's body is found, there's a scene where Will Hayward is talking with Eileen, and Donna's overhearing, but to them, it's just the two of them. And he is talking about how he's not sure he could have made it through the day like Leland had. He remarks on the brutality and the madness of this killing, that it is so awful. And obviously, the way he had to stop during the postmortem to like look at Laura's photo, he clearly has a connection to Laura, and I'm sure he's thinking of his own daughter in this situation. That up until the point where Leland would be revealed as the killer, if we assume Leland didn't do the killing of Laura Palmer, but he had taken it out on Jacques, who he believed might have been the real killer, if that's what we're going with there, it seems like Will Hayward can understand why someone would do that, and maybe why himself, why he would have done that. And, you know, he's talking about how parents shouldn't bury their children, anyone who's gone through that kind of stress that Leland has. And again, such an interesting character to me, because Doc Hayward, again, 95% of the time, calm, collected, really nice guy. But we do see that he has that anger. And if something like what happened to Leland happened to him, minus, of course, what we know about Leland later, if he lost Donna or one of his daughters in this sort of situation, I don't think it's unrealistic that if Will Hayward thought he knew who did it, he might, in a moment of passion, suffocate them. I could see that genuinely. And whether you blame him for that or not, I think it's Will understanding this sort of human element of no, I could see why someone would do that. So with Cooper, then, it does read to me, as you mentioned, standoffish, a bit cold. Like, obviously, I am on the side of Dale Cooper. You shouldn't do murder. I agree. That's generally not your role. You should want, you know, the killer apprehended, but probably don't take that in your own hands. Not just for moral reasons, but the safety reasons, everything. Don't do that. But I also think Dale Cooper in this moment isn't looking at Leland and Will Hayward with compassion of like, how does it feel to lose someone this way? And why would someone do it? It seems like Dale Cooper, again, not to tread on that territory, has this very black and white view of good and evil sometimes, where even in My Life, My Tapes, there seems to be this very stark contrast of evil being this like tangible thing. And he can't conceive of the idea of someone just in a moment of passion doing something bad out of a form of love, doing something potentially dangerous and harmful out of a sense of duty. And so Will Hayward does get that, and it reveals some of Will Hayward's darker moments. But for Cooper just to slam the door shut on that and accuse him of something, I think reads that Dale Cooper sometimes has trouble reading that aspect of people. In other ways, super attuned. In that way in particular, he doesn't quite get it.
I would agree with the part about Cooper because I look at it as that Will, he has the more sympathetic, like trying to not from the outside looking in, and Cooper has that very legalistic aspect. But I think one scene that kind of shows that even like with people in similar circles, he's still like that because after it's found out that Leland is the one that killed Laura, there's that part where everyone's walking out and they're trying to reel from it. Harry, he's trying to wrap his mind around. And you know, they're not sure if the whole Leland or Bob thing, but Major Briggs, someone else who has kids, where he talks about where it's like, you know, in this world, like, does it really matter? And Cooper says that, you know, as the FBI, it's our duty to like, you know, basically go to the nth degree for it. I know I'm paraphrasing the words, but there's just something about how Major Briggs, he's fine with the ambiguity of it, but Cooper is very legalistic. Now, so not only does he do this to like a family man, he'll do this with people who are like, you know, within his realm and his caliber of I guess justice in this regard.
And the other time that I think of with Dr. Hayward clashing with Dale Cooper, this one I'm also maybe inclined to side with Doc Hayward a little bit more, is that there's this part when Philip Gerard is giving information and he is not doing well. He is clearly like experiencing really bad side effects of what's going on, either supernatural or physical, everyone to read into it or a combination of both. And Dr. Hayward's like, we got to give him his drugs. We got to get him the medication right away. He could be in critical condition. And Cooper is prolonging it because he needs to get that information out of Mike. And if we just look at it from the grounds of the normal, typical reality that Dr. Hayward sees the world in. This is an FBI agent who outranks him in a lot of ways, but telling him we can't give these life-saving drugs to someone who's like convulsing and sweating on this bed because we need more information about the mystical demons. So I can totally understand Dr. Hayward urgently saying like, no, we gotta help him. This is one where I think Cooper's coldness can come out again. It doesn't seem like in that moment he's all that concerned about Philip Gerard, the person. I would also just, to put a little asterisk by this, extend that to how he talks about Ronette sometimes, where there's a coldness there where he wants Ronette's information, but he's not as really that concerned about Ronette.
And actually, the one thing, I'm glad you brought up Mike in particular. Of course, we're talking about the one-armed man, not Mike Nelson. But I think it's really interesting because up until this point, Doc Hayward is removed from the more fantastical aspects of Twin Peaks. Like, even if he's not explicitly told, he knows that there's something. Like, for example, I'm thinking of the scene where it's like with all the bouncing balls at the Great Northern, where they have all these people lined up. They're trying to get a sense of like who it is that's in the Great Northern that could have killed Laura. And then Ben Horn comes out and he passes out. And like, for Doc Hayward, this is like totally just like a chaotic environment. I kind of wonder, is like, do you think that he just kind of overlooked the fantastical aspects just trying to get through the day? Because it's not really addressed after this. He just kind of goes on about his life, like once the Laura Palmer murder is wrapped up. So I thought it was very unique how they actually brought Doc Hayward in for this fantastical aspect, and they never quite addressed it. He never quite acknowledged it verbally. So I don't know. It just, I always thought it was really unique.
I feel like this is an aspect where it just isn't written out. We never got much of a follow-up with Dr. Hayward, and I think that he might have more interesting thoughts and feelings if we would have got a scene where he was talking with Eileen and kind of explaining what he'd been through to whatever degree he could, but we didn't get that. So we're left with the experience of all the people who experience some element of the supernatural and the unexplained. He's one of the least questioning. He tends to just listen, see what happens, and then he does his best to move on with his life as though it hadn't happened to him. And it reminds me of his father with Margaret Lanterman, seeing the signs of what could be like an alien abduction and just calmly, scientifically, medically explaining it. And it seems like that's kind of where maybe Doc Hayward's purview is as well, is to acknowledge what's happening, but leave that to the professionals who are here to fight the supernatural evil. He's here to fight the physical unwellness and to fight and combat that sense. One little thing just to mention that I thought was interesting is with the Calhoun Memorial Hospital, which for those who don't know is named after Mark Frost's grandparents. Shout out to the wiki for explaining that to me. But the logo for that building, I don't think it's common hospital iconography from what I could tell. I could just be like missing what it is, but I've asked a few people I know when no one's known, and it's like this circle overlapping with an upside down triangle, and triangles are obviously a thing in Twin Peaks, which is what made me interested. And inside is this human figure upright inside the circle, looking almost like he's pushing up kind of on the downcast triangle. It could just be a logo they slapped together. It looks a little bit Vitruvian Man, but not quite. What it reminded me of, though, just on a surface level, it's someone pushing up against the downcast triangle. It's a hope against adverse conditions, is how I read it, that there's this figure holding things up as they're moving down. That's a Doc Hayward, if there ever was one, to me, that this is kind of this one lone man fighting this illness. But his is not the supernatural, like tangible Bob evil that Dale Cooper's after. It's people getting shot and getting poisoned and getting like every other malady possible in this town. And without any supernatural explanations, sure, something's in the air at Sparkwood in 21, because all of a sudden in a matter of a few weeks, this just keeps happening. And to paraphrase Jean Reno, maybe Dale Cooper's to blame here. I don't know.
I feel like if we're going with the fantastical aspects, the only time it could have feasibly been addressed was that within that 3 days period after Leland's death, and the wake for him, which, by the way, is a very weird thing that the Haywards of all families were the ones that had this, because it's like, oh, hey, here's this friend of the family. We found out that Leland, he raped and killed his daughter. Donna went over the house multiple times, like, you know, during this time. It's such like a strange place to have all these people centralized for this. And you could say that this is more so for Sarah above all else and like friends of the Palmer family. The more I think about it, the more just kind of weird this whole thing is conceptually, because there's just so much. And I know this is not even necessarily Doc Hayward, but it just seems like it's weird that the Hayward home would be like the place for this.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I had been wondering about all this. I remember in one of your earlier episodes on Sarah Palmer, you were talking a bit about those 3 days and how we don't see a lot of times the revelations in the characters about this. It's been something that's fueled a lot of conversations I've had off podcast with the Unplugged Professor, my co-host, in terms of who actually knows that Leland did this. Does everyone know? Does only a small number of people know? Because there's so few amounts of like reckoning with it. And of all the people I would think to reckon with this, it would be the members of the Hayward family. It would be Donna first and foremost, but also it should be Will Hayward. He should have a reaction. And I didn't even realize until you kind of brought it up there that, yeah, this is happening at his residence. Like, clearly he has to know what Leland did, right? I'm assuming this is knowledge to him. He would know this, but I never get the sense in the show that he's grappling with that realization, especially for someone who was so able to empathize with Leland up to this point, who could see himself acting in a way like Leland did, to suddenly be confronted with what Leland was. Without any supernatural explanation, that should wreck Will Hayward. That should be devastating. And I don't think that it really was conveyed. And if I read it charitably, I like to assume sometimes that maybe that's the point, is that the town itself is not prepared to have those conversations, so it sweeps it under the rug. It's not a town equipped to deal with the actual roots of trauma and violence, and that's why we just don't talk about it. Everyone knows, but we don't talk about it. But the more cynical side of me says that maybe the writers weren't prepared to handle something this big in their television soap opera, and without really a long-term vision midway through season two, this got lost. Sarah Palmer got lost. I think Ronette really got lost in the conversation. And I feel like, again, Dr. Hayward, even though he's there screen time wise, with how overworked to the bone he is, everything going on with the Palmer family on top of it, this man was like a ticking time bomb when it comes to having some sort of like emotional breakthrough. He needed to like express that in some way to someone. And I don't know if we got that.
I think the reason why I have this hang up about the Haywards where they have to know is that I mentioned this with James, is that I remember, because this is the part where season two, where a lot of people start to turn on it. And I stand by it, is that James feels like one of the few characters who's still in character, because when he goes to see Evelyn, he does talk about how he's really known the death of Laura and Maddie. And it just feels like that had to have circulated around that Leland like took part in it. If James is aware enough to be able to get away from that, that surely, you know, someone of Doc Hayward's status would be in the know, because he was working alongside with Sheriff Truman, Dale Cooper. Of course, like, he takes a backseat when season two comes around, but he was still there from the beginning. He was the one who unwrapped Laura. So to be fair, this is more so for Donna. And, you know, you could very easily say she didn't tell anyone, but Leland almost tries to kill her. Like, there's that episode, the one that Scott Frost wrote, where it's like he's leaning and he's about to do the dance like he did, not unlike with Maddie. And she looks like she's clearly violated. And like I said, that's one that Eileen and Will probably didn't know about. Maybe Donna didn't really tell anyone. But I think you did have a really good observation about people aren't ready to have those conversations, because even Donna goes back to being pretty normal. Like, strangely, like, we see her in high school more after this point than like anything from the pilot and up until this point.
Yeah, I just... This is where, up until this point in the episode, I've had a lot of back and forths. Like, I'll praise the positive qualities as I see them in Dr. Hayward. I'll side with him where I think he's right. But I think this is where we get to a potentially damning moment of his character, depending on how you read it. Because if he does know what Leland did, which I would assume by this point he would, like for all the reasons you've mentioned, then the fact that there isn't a conversation that we know about where he sits down and talks with Donna about any of this, I don't know what the right thing to say is. This is an unspeakable situation, but Donna has been through so much with not only what happened to Laura initially, her death, her best friend's death, someone she looked up to all the time, not only did she die, but to learn what happened to with Leland, learn that he was the one behind it, to learn that the same thing happened to Maddie with being killed, and that Donna was also close to Maddie at that point. James has left town. Her closest other person has left town. Donna is left alone with dead friends, friends who have moved away. The realization this could have happened to her easily. And I don't, as a viewer, see her father talk with her about any of this. Now, we can charitably assume it just happened off screen, but I'm not really given to think that, because there's no moment where that's even hinted at. So this goes into my idea that if we do read it as purposeful, that the town is sweeping it under the rug, Dr. Hayward is the most sweeping it under the rug guy, potentially, of anyone who should have a conversation with family about it. It's this one.
The only thing I could really say that would like not have that conversation, and I'm with you where it's like, I think that you could argue it happened off screen, but I really don't like that. That's actually why I'm not too big on the 3 days later jump. I think there's a lot of great arcs that could have been dealing with this issue. And also, that's not even going to the fact that this is where the tonal whiplash occurs. And the thing I was going to get at is that Will Hayward, we were actually, again, once another thing we were talking about before we recorded is that this is the busiest time for him off screen than it is for anyone else for in all of Twin Peaks, because, you know, we have Dougie Milford's death. We have the dead vagrant that Wyndham Earl brings in. We have the autopsy of Josie that we see in the Secret History. They don't say it, but he may or may not have worked on Thomas Eckhart. And then also there's the absurd stuff like having to break the news about Devil Little Nicky to Andy and Dick. And the last one, and this is going to come back around to Donna and potentially being violated, is that there's that part when Wyndham Earl poses as Gerald Craig, one of Doc Hayward's former college roommates. And when Donna mentions that, she's like Gerald Craig, he drowned when I was younger. I was there, Donna. And then he puts two and two together. So this does come back to the forefront. And to be fair, this one, it does show that he does clearly love his daughter and is concerned for her well-being. But yeah, there's just a lot that Doc Hayward is dealing with during this time of season two.
Yeah, if I can just get on my soapbox a little bit here and maybe talk a bit about all this. There's this part when he's with Shelley talking about Leo's condition in the hospital. And he says that, you know, Leo's not in pain. They can maintain his current state. They can offer nutrition and life support. But beyond that, all they have, the only ally they have, is time. And, you know, if you run with that, which I'm going to, it also feels like a bit of a prognosis for the town of Twin Peaks, where you can try to numb the pain. You can try to provide good moments, little warmth, little comforts, and you could maybe compare to nutrition and life support. But you're going to have to wait to see if any of these things actually heal, that it is completely out of our hands. Now, not that it actually is. I do think there are things you can meaningfully do, not just in the real world, but in the show of Twin Peaks, to try to confront these things. But I think that that's the attitude Dr. Hayward and many others might have, is that all we can do is wait. All we can do is wait. And for Doc Hayward to have so much of a workload, and as you mentioned before, that regret in the other material that he can't spend more time with his family, best case scenario I can read for him is he is someone who is spread so thin with his time and his energy that he simply cannot devote himself to his family to talk with them about the things that need to be talked about. And not just with everything mentioned with Laura and Leland and the Palmers, but also the town, Donna growing up, Donna reaching this pivotal age, the conversations maybe he needs to have with her, with Gersten and Harriet too, his other two daughters. He's just not there for his family to talk about these things because he's everywhere else. So if I were to try to bottle this all up into like some sort of warning or message, I feel like the message of Dr. Hayward's character ultimately comes down to, if you reach a point where you are so overworked and so spread thin that you cannot be there meaningfully for your family, this is a warning, right? This is something where you need to be able to be there for, though, and have the conversations that aren't comfortable, that you need to be able to put energy into. You can't just give yourself all the time to healing little quick fixes. And most of his advice to other people when he's not, you know, doing life-saving operations, which are great, a lot of times it's telling Ed that he should sing to Nadine, just give her comfort. He does say to play into the delusion about the high school stuff. He doesn't really have a solution for it. He just says, make her feel good in the moment. And that's really all he can offer these people. He doesn't have any other solutions. He's just running around town trying to stop the bleeding, metaphorically. And maybe literally two.
One thing I will say, or one thing I will ask better yet, is that we did bring up Harriet and Gersten. And this is more of just a thing where I think it's almost like a novelty to people. I can just write off that they're busy with a bunch of extracurricular activities, but we don't really see them all that much. We see Harriet in two episodes, and we only see, at least in the original series, Gersten in one. Do you ever have any thoughts about the relationship that they have with their parents? Like, I know that this is just like a silly thing, but since we're talking about family, I thought it was at least worth addressing how much they are or are not connected with their parents.
My podcast co-host, his headcanon was that there was a black vortex, a black hole swirling somewhere in Twin Peaks that just absorbs all the smaller characters who just go away until eventually get spat back out. Maybe that's what we saw in the return with the wormholes. But in all seriousness, as far as what it means, I feel like most of what we get for any kind of depth happens in the final dossier where they kind of where Mark Frost breaks down what happens to them, these characters. And even then, it's not obviously the complete picture of them. I do wonder sometimes, obviously, Gersten went through a lot of struggles growing up. Her father was largely absent for her adolescence, as we'll get to maybe later. And in terms of Harriet, she had a weird connection to Laura, where the little bit we get of Harriet, she's writing like poems dedicated to her, and she clearly was moved by it. But she was also young enough and maybe didn't know Laura enough to be personally that affected by it. It's hard to say how hard it hit her, because by all accounts, Harriet's the most well-adjusted young person in all of Twin Peaks. She just goes on to be like, I think it was a pediatrician or something. Like, she's just doing well, happy, good. And I'm glad for her.
Actually, the one thing, because we even talk about like the good of Doc Hayward. I mean, there's caveats to it, but I remember the first time I watched Twin Peaks for the very first time. Of course, we're going to be talking about the after Ben Horn's Civil War arc, where he's trying to make amends. And I remember for like a few episodes, I thought, oh, this is a front. This is like some long game of like something about Ghostwood. But I remember it's like when Doc Hayward, he's at the Great Northern in Ben Horn's office. Ben is talking about like the, you know, revealing the truth about Eileen. And Doc says something's like, oh, you know, I feel like you're genuine, Ben, but you got to leave certain things alone. And this is where it's starting to come to the heart of like Doc Hayward and the flaws that's rearing. I guess before we get into Doc Hayward, did you ever have any problems with thinking that Ben was being disingenuous after the Civil War arc? Or did you accept that he was actually really trying to do good in the world?
So I know that for my first time viewing the show, I believed Ben, and pretty just unconditionally. Like, my gut impulse on first viewing was like, yeah, I believe it. And as I rewatch, I still mostly feel that way. I think there's a lot of valid criticisms to raise against the Civil War scenario itself. From what I've been able to understand, there was that very popular Civil War documentary around the time, and maybe that's what leaked in. But obviously, as a narrative device, it is questionable choicing. But I will say the idea of him having to grapple with his own defeat and rise from that, I think that there was a turning point within him, and I believe he had good intentions. Now, good intentions can only get you so far, and clearly he did not know how to be good, as he said, where he's getting his advice from everyone's favorite Twin Peaks character, John Justice Wheeler. So I feel like as he's learning, he is genuinely trying to make this difference, genuinely trying to make things better. However, if you believe the Mark Frost books later with the Secret History and Final Dossier, he may also have been using that as deception to get his way with the Ghostwood projects. His environmentalism was fake. Audrey knew the truth. She was going to expose him, all that sort of stuff. I tend to feel that in the original series, I don't get that feeling. I get when I watch the original series that he was being honest. His relationship with Audrey was getting better. I don't think there was some cover up. That's just my belief watching the original show, which makes the stuff in the Mark Frost books more uncertain to me.
I guess to talk about the secret history and that aspect of Ben Horn, I actually took it as time went on that this is described in the final dossier is that it's another reality where Laura has just effectively disappeared, and that the thing, the trajectory that Ben Horn and Audrey Horn went into, it was different. And then around the time that they would have been working together on Ghostwood, they were actually really at odds with each other, because I think that the biggest rift that Ben and Audrey have, it is, I think it's in the episode where Maddie's killed, where Audrey, she knows about One-Eyed Jax and she corners him on it. And I just think that, it, had it not been, had Laura disappeared, that conversation never would have happened, and that these two would still be adversarial with each other. So at least that's my read on like the secret history versus what we see in the original series. But I did mention that thing about Doc Hayward because I generally, certainly by that point on my first time, I trust his judgment, think, oh, wait, Ben Horn, if he thinks Ben Horn's being a good guy, this must mean something. But that also makes the next couple scenes he has with Donna that much worse because she does directly question him about why Eileen went to the Great Northern and what's this weird dynamic with Ben Horn. Even the night of Miss Twin Peaks, she directly questions the both of them. And then she says that if they refuse to answer, she's just going to go ahead and ask Ben. If there's one moment where they absolutely should have said, yes, we need to have a conversation, it should have been one of these two scenes, especially the last scene. It comes back to her saying about how like keeping this stuff swept under the rug will rear its ugly head. And this was like the final warning that they had, where they could have at least tried write the ship or talk it out. Was there anything we should keep in mind before we get into the real nitty-gritty of Doc Hayward and Ben Horn's relationship?
Oh man, I just feel like there's so much here. And like I said, when I initially watched the show, I didn't understand the point of this storyline. It felt very silly to all of a sudden have Donna's true father be a question. I didn't understand it. And looking back again, as I go through, this is one of the opinions I feel I've changed the most on, where it allowed Dr. Hayward's mentality and ethics to be questioned and put under that scrutiny. For all the times he's hinted at maybe these other sides of himself, now we're getting to see, well, what does he do when he's in a family crisis? What does he actually do? And consistently, he and Eileen, I think, are on the same page that they are going to not talk about it. They're going to change the subject and they're going to tell little white lies. That when Donna asks, Doc Hayward's going to say, oh, yeah, I doubt your mom knows Ben very well. And then Donna's like, yeah, but I mean, I have evidence that she does. Oh, well, there's a fundraiser that they're doing. Yeah, it's a charity fundraiser. Completely forgot about the charity fundraiser. And it's obvious that he's lying. It's not even that clever of a lie. Donna's smart. She'll figure that out. And then at the dinner table, you could tell that Doc Hayward's having to like clue Eileen, the fundraiser. It's like really obvious that she's having to play along with this too. And I think that this is not a completely black and white situation. I think that in the real world, if you're dealing with a situation, like when do you tell your child that their biological parent might not be you? Like, when would you bring that up? I don't have an age that objectively you should do. But I think at this point, within the world of the show, what we've seen in that context, Donna is at this point 17 or 18, right? She's right at graduation age. And I think she has a right to know. That's my opinion. Like, I think not only does she have the right to know, but it's a time to do it. Like you said, there's openings. It's not like it's not getting brought up. There are direct moments where she's like, hey, if you don't tell me, I will go to Ben Horn and he will tell me. So they have ample opportunity to do this and they don't. And so two things. One, I mentioned earlier the idea of Doc Hayward being a time bomb. And I guess that's quoting Doc Hayward saying that actually about Ben, because when he's talking with Ben, you mentioned earlier that he believes he's genuine, but Doc Hayward says it's not as simple as you think it is. Quote, goodness in you, talking to Ben, is like a time bomb. There's nothing good about ruined lives. And I would spin that around and say that the secrets and lies that Doc Hayward's facilitating are also a ticking time bomb because we're seeing in real time his family's relationships dissolve, especially with Donna. She's saying how she's going to use the money from Miss Twin Peaks to study overseas, to like get away from the family. And that's a clear warning that he doesn't seem to be taking as seriously as he should. And so I think that that's particularly concerning. And I really agree with Donna in a lot of these situations too, where yeah, she's pretty emotional and reactive, which I think is understandable given the situation. But Donna seems to be more in the right, I would argue, where when she's confronting them and says, like, I'm gonna go to Ben if you don't tell me, and the parents are just standing there, just there in the room, Eileen says that there are some things, Donna, you just have to trust. And you're young, Donna, and you don't know your limitations, which I just think is nonsense to tell Donna. And Donna, correctly, I would argue, spins back and says, I know the limitations of lying. You raised me to tell the truth. I expect the same from you. And again, I think that that's a valid reply to what they're doing, that if they raise their daughter on the idea that you tell the truth, you be honest to people, then you owe it to her to do the same thing when she's 18 and about to move out.
The one scene that I think is comparable, if we're talking about other TV shows, I'm thinking about them not telling her. And I do agree that there is stuff where it's not really black and white, especially on an event like Miss Twin Peaks, like right as they're about to leave. But it does make me think of the scene that it's in the third last episode of Breaking Bad. It's when Skyler, when she's strong-armed by her sister Marie, it's like, you need to tell your son everything about you and Walter White. And if you don't, I will. And Skyler's strong-armed is like, well, it's better he hears it from me than her. So I just think that like there's times where it's like it when you're directly questioned, it's an ugly conversation, but it's so much worse because Donna does go up to him. I think it's right after Audrey gets off the stage for Miss Twin Peaks. And I think he says everything but yes, but it's very strongly alluded. But this is what really kind of sets off because we were mentioned before is that Doc Hayward is overworked like crazy with all these crazy cases, like dead bodies that are piling up. He's hosting Miss Twin Peaks, so he is basically there when Annie is abducted. And then he goes, he helps Mike Nelson with his head wound, helps Nadine. It's a really nasty, like nasty ordeal. And then he comes home to Ben Horn, where like not only is he like basically like at he is at their home and explain everything. Sylvia shows up and she's like furious. And this is just like the straw that breaks the camel's back, where Doc Hayward, he I mean, albeit unintentionally, but he splits Ben Horn's head open. And even though this is the last scene that we see of him in the season two finale, the lies actually get worse as we go through the final dossier. Like it's like lies upon lies upon lies. And Tammy, she says, I think it's in the Horns and Hayward section where she doesn't know what happened because for her, the info indicates that Ben, quote unquote, slipped and fell and he was grieving over the status of Audrey. Tammy questions why not stay at the hospital when they're both there for most of that day. And then Will, he writes down that that like Ben felt lightheaded after a couple of drinks as they were speaking privately and to implicate there's no witnesses. And then Tammy checks the medical file, which happens to be written by Doc Hayward. There's no symptoms listed for Ben's grade two concussion. And then because of all the crazy things that are going on in the season two finale, there's no Sheriff Truman or Hawk or Andy to follow up on the matter. I know that's a huge information dump diving from season two to the final dossier, but this is like we were saying before about the lies upon lies and how it just unravels. Because we'll get to stuff about Cooper, but I feel like we need to talk about like the lies he had to do in a span of a less than 24-hour time frame.
Yeah, this is Doc Hayward at his most desperate, and some of it's understandable desperation. Others, I think it's just irresponsible. I think that this is a case where I'm going to say I disagree with the character's actions. For context, again, I think the scenario leading up to this confrontation is so interesting because we have Dr. Hayward, like you said, already spread so thin. But the last place, presumably, if we go by the timeline as it seems to be presented, with, of course, underline as it seems to be presented, time in Twin Peaks, who knows? But from what it seems like, he went there, he went straight from Ed to his home. And so he could have seen that situation as a case where a truth ripped apart happiness, because that was a scene where Nadine realized what was going on, and realizing the truth is what ripped Ed and Norma apart, right? And it brought things all back crashing down. So for him to have that on his mind, driving home to talk to his family, no matter what he planned to do that night, walking in and seeing Ben already there, seeing all of this happening, you could just imagine like the match being lit in his head, right? To use the fire idea. Meanwhile, if we go by the final dossier, that would include that Ben last visited Audrey at the hospital before going to the Hayward home. And if that's the last thing he was at, he just witnessed like his own family also experience a horrible crisis where his daughter may not recover from this coma. And all of those conversations he wishes he would have had with his daughter, all of those moments he wishes he could have had that were ruined over all these years of this bad relationship between them, that were just starting to look like maybe they could heal, it got potentially blown away. So for him to go to the Hayward family, this is a chance to have those conversations with his other daughter. So looking at the setup, you have two opposing forces brought under this one roof with understandable, mixed, complicated emotions. While Ben Horn is abhorrent most of the time in the original series, this is one case where I do take his side more. I think that he didn't know how to tell the truth. I think he was messy with how he executed it. I think that the way he was doing it wasn't perfect. But I do think that he was trying his best to communicate what was actually going on to Donna, because Donna was asking questions and he could only do so much without lying. Like, he was determined to only tell the truth now. And Donna's over here asking him these questions. What's he supposed to do? He didn't go out of his way to tell her prematurely. He more just can't lie anymore. He's like, I'm done lying. If she asks me, I want to say it, but it's better if you help me. It's better, Eileen, if we both do it. But Eileen's the one making him promise that they're both going to hide it. So again, as much as I implicate Doc Hayward, Eileen seems to have the same opinion in this subject as well. I just have less to work with as far as her character. But it feels like there's this conflict that was inevitably going to happen. And I understand all the intense emotions. But this is, again, a moment where Dr. Hayward violently, physically grabbed Ben Horn. And even though his intention was not to split his head open, it was definitely an aggressive act, where Ben at this time had not initiated any physical aggression at all. This was Dr. Hayward. And I want to also mention, this is not the first time Dr. Hayward's done something with getting angry and physically being aggressive. He did that with Albert, too. So I want to mention that as well, that, yeah, Albert was definitely giving him something to argue about, but he is the one who grabbed Albert and started shaking him. This is not the first time.
I think we're going to wind down a little bit on the Ben Horn part before we move on to Cooper. But one thing I have to bring up, I'm thinking of like the significance of fire and fireplaces, especially when Lynch directs anything. And with this, you know, we have two fireplace scenes. To be fair, the first one, James, who in my Ed Hurley episode, he brought up about how like the fire was not actually lit. But there's something about like the way the fireplace is like prominently displayed when they're at the Hurley home. And Doc Hayward, he's helping with Mike Nelson and Nadine Hurley. Of course, Nadine comes to her senses and things don't go awry. But then he returns home and the fireplace, I believe, is actually on. And I always kind of thought that there's something about fire where it's like there's this malevolent force that kind of initiates like stronger emotion. Now, I think that it's enough for Doc Hayward, where there's enough on his plate to kind of set him off as a straw that breaks camel's back. But do you think that there's anything fantastical that's worth addressing?
My mind went actually more to the idea of the head injury being a recurring image, especially considering one of his next acts that he would do in his incredibly busy schedule is tend to Dale Cooper, who has to go brush his teeth and has a bleeding forehead by the end of that, not that different from Ben Horn's. But beyond just noting the superficial similarity of head injuries, also Nadine had a head injury, I don't know what to do with a commonality between them other than this idea of the brain, the skull, all the connotations of your head being damaged and what that could mean symbolically. But there is this repeated idea of someone being hit violently in the head and that causing a big issue, a big rift. So I did more of that comparison than the fireplace one, but that's completely valid too, that the fact that it's a fireplace of all areas. And then there's that weird moment shortly before, I think it's maybe the episode before, the one before that, where Ben Horn turns dramatically toward the fireplace, cue the sound effect, and then Josie, I see your face may or may not be related to it. That's always been a giant question mark as well for a lot of fans. So I don't know.
Actually, on the topic of head injuries, this actually is a very good segue into Cooper, because I was wrong in saying that that was the last scene of Will with a fireplace in the season 2 finale. And I was also even wrong about it being the last scene for the missing pieces, because when you put those scenes together, he is there for what's effectively the beginning of Mr. C when he wakes up and he slams his head in the mirror. But cutting to the missing pieces where that scene leaves off, Truman, he opens the door, he elbows his way in. And the first thing that Doc Hayward says when Mr. C, who very clearly is bleeding from the head, very clearly acting weird, he says, "You're going right back to bed." Like, I don't know why it took me until yesterday to figure out how absurd that was. And obviously, Cooper makes it to the Calhoun Memorial Hospital. You can argue that he's basically just trying to say something nice to get him into Calhoun Memorial Hospital. But it was just such like an absurd thing that I've watched so many times, and it never crossed my mind the absurdity of Doc Hayward, of all people, saying that.
And that's in the missing pieces, right? Is that in the original ending?
Oh, no, I'm pretty sure it's the missing pieces. Okay. Like, it looks so like accurate to the original series. Right. Even when we watch those scenes together, it's still hard to differentiate.
Okay, yeah, because I love the season 2 finale. It's probably my favorite episode of Twin Peaks, if I had to like pick one. And I feel like everything in there is just so perfect that I just am in love with it. But also remembering that even just looking at what has been explained in The Essential Wrapped in Plastic, that thing was thrown together by David Lynch at like the 11th hour, ad-libbing things in a crazy way off of the wild Bob Dentist script that was originally going to be there. So it's like, okay, well, maybe some weird elements could still leak in. But if it was the missing pieces, I'm really curious how that Doc Hayward line got there, if that's meant to be read into or not, because so much of Fire Walk with Missing Pieces is like loaded language you're meant to read into and stew over. So for him to say, you got to get back into bed, mister, about someone with a head wound, an open head wound, I don't know, because I don't think he's a bad doctor. I don't have any evidence that he's a bad doctor. It's weird. I don't have an explanation for it either.
That's the weird part is that, I mean, obviously this isn't like, say, Nip Tuck, where it was trying to be medically accurate despite the dramatization, but you never get a sense before this that Doc Hayward has like bad judgment or any medical malpractice, like that's like worth addressing or anything like that. It's just so strange. And the only thing that I could feasibly think of is that when they did make Fire Walk with Me, the plan was to make at least two sequels. And then those would take place after the season two finale. Maybe there's something foreboding. But I think on its own, it's just kind of like a silly thing for Doc Hayward to say. And it's pretty much the last thing we hear in The Missing Pieces, barring Cooper saying, I haven't brushed my teeth yet. Once again, acting very weird. But with that out of the way, we do know that, I'll just call him Mr. C from at this point. But because Mr. C, he goes to the Calhoun Memorial Hospital. And then Frank Truman would later on, he would ask about this because in the return, Frank is trying to figure out like the good Dal is in the lodge. So he calls up Doc Hayward and he talks about how Mr. C was acting weird. Doc Hayward was in the same ward or same hallway that Audrey was in. And he sees what he thinks is Cooper walking away, acting very out of character. And I think the thing I really have to ask is that 9 months later, Will, to be fair, I don't know if he's the one that gave birth to Richard Horn, but he has to know about the unknown father thing. Like, it's such a small town. It was such a crazy day for, you know, for all the people, especially Audrey. There has to be something about the whole unknown father and also Cooper leaving that ward where he had to put two and two together.
Well, I am wondering about the timeline because in the final dossier, doesn't it say that 3 months after the Ben Horn incident, he moved?
Yeah.
So maybe he wasn't in town 6 months prior to Richard Horn's birth. So with him relocating to Vermont, starting his new medical practice, everything going on, he might not have been in communication with many people from Twin Peaks. He certainly wasn't in communication with his family at that time. So maybe I'm missing something, but is it possible he just did not even know about Richard Horn for years?
Actually, you're right. I do have to walk back on the whole idea that he, in all likelihood, did not give birth to Richard Horn because he moves to Middlebury, Vermont, which I can't stress enough is on the complete opposite end of the country from Twin Peaks, Washington. I do have to concede I am wrong about the fact that he would be there. But he does find out eventually. I don't want to implicate him because, like, clearly, with him being Vermont, and this is, like, the early 90s, so of course, this isn't going to be, like, you know, social media where you can't, like, find out how people are doing for the most part. But he does divorce Eileen 3 months later after 26 years of marriage. Eileen stays to raise Harriet and Gerson. Donna heads to New York City. It is worth addressing that Donna definitely cuts ties with both of her parents. And then also, it's like we were saying before, Harriet becomes a pediatrician at the University of Washington, which I'm pretty sure is the same college for Doc Hayward. And then it seems like nothing really of note for Doc Hayward really goes on until 2009 when Eileen dies. And Donna, and once again, she's not talking to her father, but she's found in Eastside Crack House. And the thing is that clearly she has serious remorse for never talking to her mom, never talking it out. Like what we see in season two might actually be their last interaction ever. But with all of that out of the way, did you ever have any thoughts about how Will would handle the death of Eileen? Because not only is there that, but Donna's not talking. Harriet seems to be normal. Maybe she contacts every now and then. But Gerson is like absolutely like in a bad rut. So there's a lot of chaos that's going on with him, even beyond the other, or actually, especially on the other side of the country.
Yeah, this is, it's hard because there are times in life where you have to be able to separate ties, and maybe him moving was in a way a good decision in some aspects. And there's a lot of real life scenarios that can be similar to this that I don't want to come across as having too strong of a judgment on what is, again, not a black and white situation. But it feels as though this was especially damaging in the case of his family, that losing Donna the way that they did was ultimately, I think, preventable. I think that if they had more conversations with their daughter, more honest conversations, and not just about Ben Horn, but about a lot of the things that have been happening in Donna's life, that maybe they could have preserved that relationship. But once that separation happened, it's a question of, did Will Hayward do anything else to try to reach out that maybe Donna was rejecting over the years? What were there attempts made? I don't know if we have any information on there. It seems as though financially Eileen was doing well, because there were payments very clearly from Ben Horn of $7,500 every month until Eileen's passing. So she had money to raise the children. And interestingly enough, those would not have been Ben Horn's children. They would have been Will Hayward's children. I don't know if it's clear if, in addition to that money, that Will was also paying Eileen. It is not stated. So since it's not stated, I would not think so. So I don't think he was paying any child support of any kind. Instead, Ben was funding the raising of those children. And if Will was not making any effort to engage them, which I don't think we have any evidence of, it feels like he really did just leave and completely drop them for like 40 years. And that's really hard. Regardless of putting moral judgments into it, that's just hard for family. That's hard for those kids growing up. And obviously, that can affect children different ways. I actually like that we have Harriet as a counterexample, because not every time is a child of a messy divorce going to be having a tough time. Some kids bounce back and some kids don't. And that's just how it is in real life sometimes, that not every child's going to react the same way. So I think having Harriet adjust a little bit differently is nice to see. It's not so binary of a situation. But it does make me wonder what attempts have been made. And I think what's also so harmful is, if truly the last time that Donna had seen Eileen or her father, because we know that he divorced and moved like a few months later, but we don't know if Donna was speaking to them in that 3 month period before he left. But if that was one of the last times they talked, Donna's like, one of the last things she said to her father with Will Hayward was clinging to him, saying, "You're my father, you're my," like, over and over again, because she's so distraught about what's happening with Ben. So to have that like searing memory of her latching onto him for dear life, reaffirming that he's her father, and then for him to leave and never speak again, not to shift all the blame on him, but that's just devastating, in my opinion.
Although I guess that things do patch up, it takes a long time because it's after 20 plus years of silence. Donna is actually the first one to reach out to Will. And when I wrote it down, I initially thought to myself, oh, why wouldn't Will reach out? And I actually thought to myself that maybe like Donna was so cut off, especially because like she's going through rough patches for a while leading up to this event, that Donna would be the only one to really know how to reach out to Will. But she would move to Vermont near him and would help out as his assistant. And Will, he's slowly winding down, but never really fully intends to retire. And then Donna, she doesn't talk to Tammy. So, I mean, to be fair, it's the final dossier. You can't really confirm that much to begin with. But because Donna doesn't talk to Tammy, that there's not really a whole lot to confirm or deny. But the fact that she does remain at her father's side does say a lot, though. I know that we're mostly winding down with the final dossier and a little bit for the return for now, but anything about the relationship of Donna finally bearing the hatchet or any other relationships with the family worth addressing?
I'm glad you corrected me a little bit there, that yeah, I for some reason said he'd waited 40 years. No, he'd waited 20 years. She is now 40 years old. I misread there. So yeah, it was a 20-year drought in communication. And you're right that maybe it wasn't possible for him to actually locate where Donna was and actually communicate. We know that he knows how to use Skype, but we don't know how easy it is for him to navigate social media, or how much Donna was even on social media, how many Donna Haywards there are in the New York area, if he even knew if she still was in New York. Clearly, she was in and out of rehabilitation. She was probably not the easiest person for him to find. So to be a bit more on the lenient side here with Dr. Hayward, there's a chance that maybe he had wanted to patch things over that 20 years, but just wasn't able to. That's totally possible. I think that's a valid reading of him as well. I feel like with the relationships, I don't have anything else with his family relationships. I do just want to note that at the beginning of Frank Truman's call with him, he does ask how Harry is doing. So even though he doesn't have a strong connection to the town of Twin Peaks anymore, we're not sure how much he's communicating with people. He does readily welcome the call and does inquire about Harry. So there is a sense of even 20 years later, he does still have that connection.
And I guess one thing that's worth mentioning is that Frank Truman, he shows up pretty much right when Harry falls ill. So this is way after Will leaves for Vermont. But I think that because Frank, he wasn't in Twin Peaks for decades at that point, I think there's something to be said about the fact that he can talk to Frank so readily that there is at least some sort of connection that he has. And also just how just seemingly friendly terms. And of course, I know this is Twin Peaks, like, a lot of people sort of like, even the Fire Walk Me tagline in a town like Twin Peaks, no one is innocent. But I really have a hard time believing that Frank or Will would have like any animosity. Like even like with Frank, I mentioned this in my Frank Truman episode, but even with Ben Horn, Ben Horn was like not exactly the best person for a long time. I'm sure Frank knew it, but he could go up to him and was like very cordial. So yeah, I don't know. I do like the endearing relationship that they have, even if it is just like on like very surface level speaking terms.
I also want to mention here that I am someone on our podcast who I might be one of the more vocally anti Twin Peaks The Return podcasters out there in the Twin Peaks podcasting world. And even with my mixed and sort of negative feelings on The Return as a whole, and I don't particularly love the Skype call conversation because it feels to me like it awkwardly is inserted into the story. And it's a lot of just like exposition and recap. Not a huge fan of the scene, but I do want to at least acknowledge that I appreciate any attempt that were made during the production of The Return to bring in cast members, especially those who were older or having health complications. So I'm glad that we got Warren Frost in for another scene, even if I have mixed feelings on that scene itself. And none of my like negative feelings or mixed feelings on the character of Dr. Hayward have anything to do with Warren Frost's performance, which I think is quite good throughout all of the continuity.
This is more behind the scenes aspect, but one thing I do like is that I think it was among one of the first scenes that was filmed for The Return, because I think it was filmed filmed in Warren Frost's backyard, where Mark Frost, Scott Frost, Mark Frost's son, whose name escapes me at the moment, where they actually were the ones who were kind of setting everything up. I'm sure that Lynch probably had some factor in it, but it was mostly the Frost family that was bringing this scene together. So I think there's something really endearing about Mark Frost being able to be there with his father to film this. But I think that pretty much wraps up everything about Doc Hayward. Was there any final thoughts we should kind of keep in mind now that we've discussed everything throughout the books and all three seasons and also the missing pieces?
I just want to touch a little bit on the Albert confrontation, because that was one of the moments for me. It's probably the first moment when I felt a rift of like, Doc Hayward, I'm not 100% sure I agree with everything this person stands for, was probably this moment, because we all know that Albert has a fiery tongue, that he is someone who can dish it out very readily to anyone, especially small town practitioners that he's not especially fond of. But I do feel like Doc Hayward's responses here are pretty interesting, because Albert is doing a fairly routine autopsy on an FBI serial murder case where not only was someone brutally murdered, but that this has links to other murders and could happen again. And the whole point was that Albert wanted to get this done and then still hopefully have the body available to be there for the funeral ceremony. And it was, because at the end of this encounter, he did get it done in time. So it feels to me like Dr. Hayward's aggressive confrontations and refusal to let him look at Laura's body didn't seem like they were necessary. Like, if you just let the man do his job, he was gonna get it done. But instead, Doc Hayward says that Albert is the most cold-blooded man he's ever seen. He accuses him of having no compassion whatsoever. And so, again, like I mentioned before, he grabs him by the collar, starts shaking him. And it made me feel that, humorously enough, at that pilot moment when Agent Cooper pulls Harry aside and says, you know, sometimes local law enforcement don't like the FBI getting their way. Like, he has that conversation, right? Harry's not the one that had clashes with the FBI. It's Doc Hayward. Doc Hayward's the one who clashed with the FBI involvement, which I just think is interesting. And generally, Cooper stays in the middle more on the town side when it comes to Albert confrontations early on. But I do feel that Albert was more in the right here to do the autopsy, as you would, to investigate the case. He's good at his job. Let the man work, and then you'll have your funeral later. It's okay to look at the body. And I feel like him getting in the way of that is so aggressive and really just uncalled for. He should know, as a medical professional, the importance of this autopsy. Like, it just seems baffling to me.
I think the two things that stand out to me for this part is, strangely enough, it's that device, it's that drill that Albert has. It's like the most over-the-top, comedically large drill, which makes it look so much more invasive than any medical procedure probably would. But the strangest part is that out of those two, I think it's really just there's someone else at Calhoun Memorial Hospital and Ben Horn is there on behalf of the Palmers. It's very strange that out of that scene, Ben Horn, the one with like the most awful interaction with Laura by far out of everyone in that room, he's the one that's actually the most civil. I was like, how does this happen? How is Ben, the guy who slept with the dead girl, how is he the one who's acting neutral out of all this? It's like we were talking about with Doc Hayward and Cooper when Cooper asked if he endorsed murder after Leland clearly kills Jacques. There's that certain empathy of like trying to be in someone's shoes versus the legalistic aspect. But yeah, I think I never even thought about the significance of Will just grabbing Albert and how that would kind of set a precedent for all the subsequent stuff that would happen in season two.
And knowing what we know later about Albert, his belief in nonviolence and the way in which he would become so much more prominent in the show, ultimately replacing him as the fourth hero in that lineup, if you want to contrast that lineup shot in season one versus the walking shot in season four, it feels as though that was a start of a turning point where narratively Albert did take more precedence and would go on to take more precedence. And the values that maybe Albert represents versus Dr. Hayward, there is something to discuss there and to contrast in addition to Cooper. And it's, as always with Twin Peaks, not so simple as one is always right, one is always wrong. There are cases where Cooper can be very cold and unfeeling toward the situation, but there are also moments where Dr. Hayward gets in the way of the investigation and also is fueling that attitude of sweeping things under the rug. So again, thank you so much for letting me be a part of this episode, because when I was thinking of, you know, different characters in the show to talk about, Dr. Hayward is just one that I find so fascinating because he is this mix. And I feel like if any character represented that idea in Twin Peaks of the lies and secrets that need to be talked about, again, going back to James's line that secrets are what tear people apart and tear their chances of happiness away, I think that is a running theme throughout a lot of Twin Peaks. And it's not like Dr. Hayward's the most heinous person. I would still say he's one of the nicest guys you'll meet. And there's a reason why Laura found him so comforting. But you need to be able to have those conversations and those talks to have the long-term healing. And that can't just be something pacifying or a nice word or a gentle smile. You have to have those hard conversations and really investigate the roots of the problems, which is something that I feel like as the show went on, more and more characters were becoming opposed to doing, with Doc Hayward being one of them. I do wish we had gotten that scene where he should have talked to his family about what happened. But in lieu of that, he becomes part of that problem, part of that thesis, I would argue, about Twin Peaks. And humorously enough, Ben Horn, one of the worst people in the planet, turns. And I think he's right for having those hard conversations. Even if Ben doesn't always know how to breach them, how to word them, he is someone going out of his way to try. And not to step too much on the Ben Horn territory, but it does make me wonder if the last time in season two that he tried to have a hard conversation, he got his skull bleeding out. How likely is he to want to do that again? What does that say about Ben's future between season two and the return? How likely is he to do that hardest truth first anymore after what happened that night? It makes me wonder about Ben too.
As far as Ben, because this does tie into the ramifications of Doc Hayward cracking his head open, quite frankly, I took it as that Ben, he does end up, in my opinion, I think he does go on the straight and narrow. We see this with giving money to Eileen every month from 1989 until her death 20 plus years later. And then also we see it where even like after everything with Annie Blackburn, where he's like one of the biggest people like donating to help Annie. So I think that he views it as almost like he's trying to do the right thing. And it's a very tough for him, but I think he realized that there has to be ways to go about it. But having said that, the fact that Doc Hayward would instinctively try to just like crack his head open, albeit accidentally, there is probably like that scene when Dick Tremaine comes up to him and talks about getting a lawyer. He's like, sometimes the desire to do bad outweighs the desire to do good. But then he pulls out the carrot. I think that's kind of emblematic of his character, even just a tiny bit from that point onward. But anyways, I think with that, I just want to thank you for coming on because there's a lot of insight about Doc Hayward that I never even thought of, just because it's like we were talking about before, and like, you know, there's a lot of passive parts where he's in so many scenes, but he's not really talked about. So I'm glad that we got to have an episode to really talk about like how it was with him with the work-life balance and everything that follows that.
No, absolutely. And that's one of my favorite things about what you do on this podcast is that like actual activity of taking a character and viewing them through the lens of this is their story. Like if they are the main character of Twin Peaks, what does that look like? What does that mean? And I think that allows us to have so many interesting conversations about the show that sometimes we just miss when we're looking at the biggest of all pictures, or if we only look at, you know, the big names like Dale Cooper. I think when we step aside and look at just the background people, sometimes it can lead to these really interesting insights that otherwise you wouldn't be able to have. And that's so fun to do with media.
Absolutely. But yeah, I think that wraps everything up. So thank you for coming on. And yeah, you're always welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. If anyone's looking to keep track of where I am at, I am on Twitter, also known as X, also known as whatever it's called when you listen to this episode, at Snake Eye Dreams One. I'm also, like I said, on YouTube at Snake Eye Dreams. I do videos, a whole podcast on Twin Peaks, 78 episodes long. And I didn't mention this earlier. The conceit of that podcast was showing a first-time viewer all of Twin Peaks media with the original series going into the return, but also priming this person with all the books, with all the David Lynch films. We dived into like all of the special features on the Z to A collection for hours and hours and hours. And if you want like two eccentric weirdos talking about this show that have kind of an offbeat sense of humor, I think we did pretty good by it. If you can handle our first few episodes, we were just getting settled, you know. Don't judge us too hard for the first few, but we had a lot of fun doing it. And it's great to be able to talk about Twin Peaks again. Together.